In this last week of 2011, All Things Considered, along with other NPR programs, will be highlighting people, ideas, and businesses that had a good year. And 2011 was a good year for hell. Satan's domain has received a lot of press, from Hollywood to doomsday prophets to New York Times bestsellers. In fact, this year has seen an incendiary debate about the existence and contents of hell. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty takes the hot seat.
The year began with an epic battle between a priest and Satan.
It is God who commands you your name! Your name! Give me your name!
That's Anthony Hopkins playing a priest possessed by a major demon in the movie The Rite. The Hollywood glimpse of the underworld came and went without much notice by moviegoers. But then another form of hell on earth grabbed the headlines. Judgment Day would soon be upon us.
Oh, it will be a horror story beyond measure.
Harold Camping, the doomsday prophet and founder of Family Radio, read between the lines of the Bible and proclaimed that on May 21st, an earthquake would convulse the entire world, time zone by time zone. Christian believers would fly up into the air to meet Jesus. As for those left behind,
there will be weeping and wailing because everybody will realize this is it. Judgment Day has come.
When the day came and went without event, Camping and his followers, some of whom had given up jobs and family to spread the word, had one simple question.
What in the world happened?
Camping argued that a spiritual judgment had occurred. He had a stroke a few weeks later, and his prediction that the earth would be destroyed in October also failed. But if hell did not make a physical appearance on earth, it made a huge splash in the book industry, jump-started by this promotional video from one of the nation's most influential evangelicals.
Will only a few select people make it to heaven? And will billions and billions of people burn forever in hell?
Rob Bell, whose hip, riveting preaching style drew thousands to his church and brought him worldwide fame, wrote a book that takes aim at this fundamental evangelical belief. He says he began thinking about hell when his church put on an art show about peacemaking, and one of the pieces featured Mahatma Gandhi.
And somebody had attached to the piece with Gandhi this handwritten note that said, "Reality check, he's in hell." And it was such a... like, really? That's the gospel of Jesus? That's the good news?
Bell's book, Love Wins, argues that God's grace and love mean that many people, maybe all people, will spend eternity with God in heaven, not just Christians.
Buddhists, Hindus, people of Jewish faith, do I think there will be all sorts of people reconciled to God, present in heaven, however and whatever that is? Of course. The thing I think you'll hear the most in heaven is, wow. That's awesome.
Bell did not argue that hell does not exist. He said people can choose to be in hell by definitively rejecting God's grace. But he says that God is tireless in trying to win every person over, and eventually love wins. This popular message sent Bell's book soaring to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. Then came the blowback, and it was hotter than you know what.
Well, first of all, I believe the man is a false teacher. I believe he's a heretic because the Bible's very...
My heart goes out to him because he is really deceived.
So here comes Rob Bell. He's made a Christian gospel for you, and it's perfectly palatable. It's much easier to swallow. That's what you've done, haven't you?
No, I haven't. And there's actually an entire chapter in the book on hell. And there's
That's evangelist Franklin Graham, pastor and author John MacArthur, and MSNBC host Martin Bashir. Bell's book spawned a bevy of new books on hell, pro and con. Among the authors was a friend and pastor, Francis Chan. When he got Bell's book, he was secretly hopeful.
Because I thought, maybe he's right, and I no longer have to worry about this place. I no longer have to warn people about this place. I want to believe what Rob Bell believes.
But when Chan studied the Bible, and particularly Jesus' teachings, he concluded that there is a place of torment called hell. He wrote his book, Erasing Hell, to counter Bell's kinder, gentler message. What happens if Bell is wrong, Chan worries, and people become complacent about their eternal destiny?
If you were going to jump out of a plane and someone threw a backpack on you and say, "Trust me, it's a parachute," and I've opened it up, I go, "No, it's just a backpack." It's not going to work. And so in the same way, if there's this belief that, well, you know what, God's going to let us all go. And I'm going, no, I've looked. I've looked into the scriptures, and that is not what I see.
For his part, Rob Bell says that this turn or burn mantra distorts Christianity and drives people away from the faith.
What harms people is when a pastor gets up at a funeral and says, "Hi, everybody, we're here today because Uncle Bob died, and I want you to know for sure that Uncle Bob is burning in hell forever." That hurts people.
So, why is 2011 the year for hell? It's not as if this is a new concept. What's happened, says Lauren Winner at Duke Divinity School, is that Bell's book exposed a debate among evangelicals that's been percolating underground for years. She says younger Christians in particular are squeamish about the idea that their non-Christian friends and family will burn.
If you live next door to a Muslim and you work in a cubicle next to a Wiccan, you may be a very devout conservative Christian, but you may also be very uncomfortable imagining that those people are not going to be with you eternally.
In the end, Rob Bell says, hell remains a mystery.
It's speculation. Like, nobody died and came back with video footage.
Speculation that sparked one of the most contentious debates of 2011. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Here's one of the complications of Egypt's parliamentary elections, where Islamist parties have so far done very well.
The new parliament will face pressure to improve Egypt's economy, which was disrupted by this year's protests.
A big part of the economy is tourism, as you'd expect in a country that has the pyramids and all the attractions of the Nile.
But Islamists aren't sure they like all those foreign tourists who don't endorse the lawmakers' conservative view of Islam. NPR's Soraya Sahardi-Nelson reports from Cairo.
The Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party got a lot of votes from vendors here at the Khan al-Khalili market, a hub for tourists in Islamic Cairo with its narrow twisting lanes and soaring minarets. Mohammed Reda has stickers of the party plastered next to the pyramid paperweights and statuettes he sells. He says the merchants here are counting on the Islamists to bring back business to their neighborhood. Continuing violence and political unrest have kept tourists away from this and other Egyptian landmarks. Officials say the number of visitors this holiday season is down by more than a third compared to the same time last year. Vendors clamor for the few tourists who do wander through the shop-filled alleys. They offer trinkets for a dollar or two in a desperate attempt to make a sale.
£7, come on. £7, okay. I accept your prize, man. Come on.
Reinvigorating tourism is something the vendors want the new parliament to make its top priority. They see the Islamists as honest brokers, devoid of the corruption and greed that plagued the Mubarak government. But some of the things newly elected Islamist lawmakers are saying have many in Egypt's tourist trade scratching their heads. Recently, Brotherhood Party member Azza Al-Gharf told a crowd of supporters in front of the Great Pyramids that tourists can do without alcohol when they come to Egypt. Ultra-conservative Salafist candidates have taken it a step further by demanding a ban on all alcohol sales. They've also called for segregating Egypt's beaches by sex and banning revealing swimwear. Such proposals will only make the tourism slump worse, predicts Mohammed Al-Gendi, who sells religious trinkets in the Khan al-Khalili market. Egyptian tourism experts and officials agree. Hisham Zazu is the senior assistant tourism minister.
These are irresponsible statements, in my opinion, that even if said by responsible people, I believe they do not understand the setup of the industry and the dynamics of it.
The math is simple, Zazu says. 4 out of 5 tourists who come to Egypt do so for leisure vacations at the beach rather than to visit the pyramids or other historical sites. More than 3/4 of all visitors to Egypt are from Europe, and they expect to be able to enjoy the beach as they would at home, he adds.
To swim, you wear a bathing costume. To have dinner, part of the culture is to have a drink with the dinner. This is the kind of information people have to understand that do not understand the industry. And you don't change the culture of people.
But Islamist lawmaker Azza Al-Gharf says Egyptian officials need to rethink their approach to tourism. She argues that appealing to Muslim visitors abroad and domestically will boost tourism. So would hosting more international conferences here. She adds that separate beaches for women and curbing public consumption of alcohol wouldn't affect these new markets or even the old ones. Such pronouncements are naive, says Elhami El-Zayat, who chairs the Egyptian Tourism Federation and runs a company specializing in conference tourism. He says he's talked with the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists at length about their tourism proposals and why they won't work. He believes that once the Islamists are in power and faced with a financial reality, they will stop trying to make Egyptian tourism conform to a more conservative Islamic lifestyle.
If they were not pragmatic, could they have collected so many votes? They were very pragmatic and very sly. We have to remember this.
Hisham Galal, a vendor in the Khan al-Khalili market, warns that if Islamists don't back down, he and many other Egyptians will hold mass protests to force them out of office, just like they did with Mubarak. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
Christmas has yet to arrive in Egypt, where the Coptic Christian minority celebrates January 7th. A leader of one of the most conservative Islamist parties has declared it will be un-Islamic for Muslims even to wish Christians well on Christmas. The Coptic Christian Pope says people of all faiths should be invited to Christmas celebrations, including radical Muslims. And the most prominent Muslim group, the Muslim Brotherhood, is taking a conciliatory approach, actually pledging to protect Christian churches.
We are going to stay on the topic of politics and take a closer look at a candidate whom supporters hope will be the breakout star of the Iowa caucuses. That is former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum. Recent polls show him surging into third place among the Republican presidential contenders. That's after months at the back of the pack. Among those converts to Santorum's camp is one particularly influential voice in Iowa politics, particularly on the Republican side. That is Bob Vanderplaats. He is the president and CEO of the Iowa-based organization called The Family Leader. It takes a conservative view of social issues, and he's back with us once again. Mr. Vanderplaats, thank you so much for joining us once again. Happy New Year to you.
Well, Michelle, Happy New Year to you and to your listeners, and thank you for having me on your program.
You know, when we last spoke in April, you had already been approached by every candidate then in the race, as I recall, and even some who had not made the decision to jump in. At the time we spoke, you said your goal was, and I do want to, this is a good point to place to point out that your endorsement is a personal one, right? It's your personal
endorsement. It is a personal endorsement.
Not the organizational one. But at the time you said that the goal was have a level playing field, find out the candidate's core values and convictions, what's their vision for the country, and can they beat President Obama? So how did you personally decide that Rick Santorum was the guy who fit that bill?
Well, first of all, we're very sold on Rick Santorum with his core values, his convictions. We believe we can trust him. We believe he's a man of integrity. And even people who disagree with him about his conclusions on issues, they don't find him disagreeable. We also believe he has a great vision for this country. He was kind of Tea Party before Tea Party was cool. He was part of the Gang of Seven. And then can he beat Barack Obama? We have to look back at history. He defeated three incumbent Democrats on his way to become a congressman and then a U.S. senator. We believe Rick Santorum has what it takes not only to lead this country, but also to defeat Barack Obama and to carry our values into the White House.
But he also couldn't defend his own Senate seat.
Well, he couldn't defend his own Senate seat in the 2006 race, and he was the number one target by the Democrats. Pennsylvania is a fairly blue state. They saw Rick Santorum as a huge threat. And if you'll recall, Michelle, 2006 was a bad year for any Republican on the ticket, and especially when you're the number one target by the Democrats.
Well, and there's also been an interesting wrinkle to the story. We talked about the whole question of whether this is a personal or the endorsement of your organization. Since you've come out in support of Rick Santorum, there's been a lot of back and forth over whether you are trying to pressure other candidates, other socially conservative candidates to get out of the race and that's what. Now, you've said publicly you just think it's just common sense for people who share a certain skill set and values perspective to coalesce around one candidate. Could you just tell us, though, what do you think is going on, or how do you interpret all this anger around your decision to support Rick Santorum? In fact, I have to mention that Michelle Bachmann, for example, who had an early surge in Iowa, has said that you actually tried to pressure her to get out.
Well, you know, I can see some of the emotion around my endorsement of Rick Santorum, especially when you're not the one that I endorsed. However, we've been looking at this process for months. You talked about me being on your program back in April. A lot of us who have been sizing up this field, we've seen it for what it is that we are fragmenting our vote amongst many good pro-family conservative candidates. And if we continue to do that, the nominee or the person we're going to launch out of Iowa is going to be Governor Mitt Romney. we're kind of looking for that alternative to Romney. So it only makes sense for if there to be a teaming or a coalescing. Now, I never called Michelle Bachmann to pressure her to get out of the race, but I did call Michelle Bachmann. I did call Rick Perry. I did call Rick Santorum. And I planted the seed about if we team, united we stand, but divided I believe we're going to fall. And I said that can't be a Bob Ehrenplatz decision. That has to be a candidate-to-candidate decision. And I'm telling you, Michelle, that for people on the ground here in Iowa, if they saw a candidate lead that way to say, you know, this is about the cause of the country, it's not about me personally, this is about us winning not only the Iowa caucuses but the primary and then to beat Obama, I think you'd see people just rally around that.
However, that didn't happen.
And so what I did is I went out and I endorsed Rick Santorum. And I think what you're seeing right now is that conservatives are starting to coalesce on their own. They see Rick Santorum as the person who can win the Iowa caucuses, then go on to beat Romney and go on to beat Obama.
I do want to ask you a little bit about this, the quest to beat President Obama. Obviously, if you're a Republican, you want your team to win. But we had a conversation yesterday with Kevin Williamson of the conservative magazine, The National Review, and he described conservatives' feelings about the president this way. Here it is.
The real dynamic on the right now is between people who dislike Barack Obama and think his policies are wrong and people who hate Barack Obama and think that he's evil.
Why do they hate him?
Well, I think partly it's cultural, partly it's that he does pursue some pretty bad policies.
Well, what's your, and obviously you had a longer answer than that, but what's your take on that? I mean, do you really, is the issue here hatred for President Obama? What's your take on this?
Michelle, absolutely not. And I hope none of us are motivated by hate. And if, for those of us who call ourselves Christians, if we're motivated by hate, that's not a Christian value. Matter of fact, I happen to respect and admire President Obama and his wife, Michelle, for their marriage to one another, as well as being a great example of raising their two young daughters. That's where I respect and admire President Obama. Where I have a disagreement with President Obama is in his policies. He's had a very mixed bag of policies as it relates to Israel. He won't defend the Defense of Marriage Act. He won't stand up for one man, one woman marriage. The universal health care. I just believe a lot of things are at risk in regards to our faith, our family, and our freedom under President Obama. It is not motivated by hate whatsoever. Matter of fact, I have great admiration for him breaking that that race barrier, being our first African-American president. I think that's a very good thing. His family values that he demonstrates with his own family, I think it's a very good thing. It's the policy issues that we have disagreement on, not that we have hatred about. That's what I think makes America great, that we can discuss our disagreements, but it's not filled with hatred. I would never be about that.
And finally, before we let you go, and we only have a minute left, and I do hope we'll talk again
soon. I do want to.
The polls all show that while many people consider the social issues important, the economy really is foremost in many voters' minds. How does somebody like Rick Santorum, and we only have, I'm sorry, 45 seconds left on this, distinguish himself on an issue like this?
Well, I think Rick Santorum has been very clear about the economy and limited government, and he ties it back to the family, that if we have strong marriages, we'll have strong families. If we have strong families, we can have limited government, and we also can have a thriving economy. But you have to get back to strong families first. And I think even fiscal conservatives, and I've studied economics and I've taught economics, they're starting to make that connection that social conservatism and fiscal conservatism have to walk hand in hand for the betterment of the future of this country.
That was Bob Vanderplatz. He is the president and CEO of the Iowa-based organization, The Family Leader. He joined us from Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. And, of course, Iowa moves into the national spotlight next week with the Iowa caucuses on January 3rd. Mr. Vanderplatz, thank you so much for joining us once again. Happy New Year to you.
Michelle, same to you. Thank you.
In eastern Oregon, Native American tribes are holding their traditional New Year ceremonies, which begin at the time of the winter solstice. Anna King of the Northwest News Network visited the Umatilla tribe and has this report on the ceremony, which welcomes the year's new foods.
Armin Minthorn is the spiritual leader of the tribes that live on the Umatilla Reservation on the dry side of Oregon. The celebration is called Kimti Imnuit.
This goes back to when the world was new. And the first food that was created was the salmon we call Natsoch.
Minthorn explains that the Indian New Year is the time to celebrate the return of the sacred foods.
The second food was the deer, and we call the deer Nukt.
These foods will come back to the Indian people as the sunlight hours begin to stretch again.
The third is the bitterroot we call Sliton.
To honor these sacred foods, the tribe sings, drums, dances, prays, and shares a meal together at the longhouse. In the community kitchen, some elder women prepare meat stew and Indian fry bread. Lin Sue Jones is tiny with a soft, round face. She kneads a mass of tacky bread dough to a loose rhythm.
We can be able to face our demons and take care of our health a little bit better, and I'm glad I'll be able to see another year to begin with.
Lin Sue Jones is 62. She is taking on new responsibilities this year, raising two granddaughters, 3 and 5.
I just want to ask the Creator to give me the strength to do right by them, you know. I want to teach them the longhouse way out.
The tribe's children sing to the elders during the community meal. Lin Sue Jones's sister, Linda Jones, listens nearby as she stretches small balls of dough. She flattens each one, then floats them in sizzling oil. Tribal elder Linda Jones teaches younger women and girls how to gather the traditional foods for the tribes. Every year she goes out to the mountains and bluffs to harvest the wild celery, bitter roots, and huckleberries. Jones says the foods are sacred because they nourish the people, but also...
When our elders pass on and go back to the ground, this is how they come back to take care of us in these foods.
Some of Linda's long, long hair is silver. She worries not enough young people are living the tribe's traditions. Sometimes she has to gather the sacred foods alone.
Everything is passed by word of mouth, and that's how we were brought up, and that's how we do things to whoever will listen. It ends up coming down to that, who's going to listen.
Jones hopes to kindle enough interest in the ancestors' teachings so the Umatilla tribes have enough hands to bring in the sacred foods this year and in the years to come. For NPR News, I'm Anna King in Mission, Oregon.